Hi, welcome to this week's program. Gong hai fat soi. Gong hai fat soi to all my listeners. Now, I know a lot of you probably are going, huh? What did he just say? But I'm hoping at least a few of you smiled and nodded your heads when I said that. You see, gong hai fat soi is a popular Chinese New Year greeting in Cantonese, and it directly translates to wishing you great happiness and prosperity, and was commonly heard on February 16, 2018, when China celebrated its Lunar New Year, welcoming the Year of the Dog. Now, each year, the Chinese calendar is assigned an animal of the zodiac, and this pattern is repeated every 12 years. Last year was the Year of the Rooster, and the year before that was the Year of the Monkey, and this is the Year of the Dog. So, what can markets expect in 2018 from the Year of the Dog? To get some clues, I conjured the thoughts of my old pal Sam Stovall from CFRA Research, who looked back to prior years of the dog, 1934, 46, 58, 1970, 82, 94, and 2006. Notice the 12-year pattern. Here's what he found. In 1934, the S&P 500 was down 1.2%. In 46, it was down 8.5%. Now, in 1958, markets were up a whopping 44%, 70 up 3.6, 1982 up an amazing 20%, 1994 up 1.3%, and in 2006, 12 years ago, the S&P 500 was up a very solid 15.5%. So, in years of the dog since 1934, markets were down just 2 times with only modest dips and were up 5 times with very respectable gains in 3 of those 5 up years. The worst year of the dog was in 1946 when the markets were down 8.5%, and the best was 1958 with stocks up 43.7%. So, what might this year of the dog give us? Well, with the S&P 500 up almost 16% over the just concluded year of the rooster, with stocks strongly up since March 2009, and with significant recent volatility, I think it's a little unlikely, but not out of the question, that we'd have outsized returns. If history is anything to go by, our worst case could be a correction of about 10% in line with the 8.5% drop in 1946's Year of the Dog. In general, the Year of the Dog hasn't been too brutal on the markets, so let's hope that's the case this time too. So I started to think about other calendars and patterns that might light the way to the future. Let's look at the predictive powers of the Mayan calendar. The Mayan calendar system consists of the long count calendar over a span of 5,125 years, and the end of the long calendar signals the end of the world and the celebration of a new cosmic dawn. Friday, December 21st, 2012, marked the end of that world, according to the Mayans, but that date fortunately passed without any great upheaval, and most of us live to see the cosmic dawn. I guess the Mayans were off by a few years. You know, had their long count calendar ended March 6th of 2009, when the market was just recovering from the banking collapse, I might have well been a believer in the Mayans' power of predicting a new cosmic dawn. But alas, with markets in the middle of a solid upswing in December 2012, I have to admit my faith in the powers of prophecy was a bit shaken. So if you think of a calendar as a series of patterns, whether it be 12 years in Chinese or 12 months in the Judeo-Christian calendar, other patterns come to mind. One such pattern that appears in nature is the Fibonacci sequence. It's basically a simple series that starts with the number 1, and every subsequent number in the series is the sum of the 2 previous numbers. So it's 1, and then it's 1 again, and then it's 2, 3, 5, 8, and 13. So you see the 2 was the sum of the 1 and the 1 before it, the 3 was the sum of the 2 and the 1 before that, and so on. What's interesting, especially about this simple sequence, is the ratio of each number to its preceding number. So remember I said the last 2 numbers were 8 and 13? Well, if you look at the ratio of those two numbers, 13, and you divide it by 8, it's about 1.6. 8 divided by 5, which is the number before it, is 1.6. 5 divided by 3 is about 1.6, and so on. In fact, the average of all these ratios work out to be about 1.6. And that's the golden ratio, as it's called because it's seen a lot in nature. For instance, the ratio of female to male honeybees in a hive is about 1.6. Sunflowers, which have opposing spiral seeds, have a 1.6 ratio between the diameters of each rotation. Now look closer to your own body. Measure the distance from your head to your feet and divide that by the length from your belly button to your feet. You're going to get somewhere around the range of 1.6. This golden ratio also seems ubiquitous in the stock market, with price movements and new support and resistance levels connected to Fibonacci percentages. And if you're interested in checking this out further, there's plenty of links online. Fibonacci is Fibonacci. Then there's the Elliott wave theory, which is often used in conjunction with the Fibonacci ratios. The theory is named after Ralph Nelson Elliott, who used the rhythms of nature to suggest that markets move up in a series of 5 waves and down in a series of 3 waves. But while other theories try to time market movements, Elliott suggested no absolute time requirements for a cycle to complete, which was pretty smart of him because, as we all know, the timing and duration of a bull or bear market is virtually impossible to predict. As John Maynard Keynes famously said once, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. So getting the timing right, especially if you're speculating, is imperative. Now, there's no scientific basis for the predictive powers of the Chinese zodiac or the Mayan calendar, or arguably of Fibonacci or Elliott wave or anything else I've ever seen. Maybe the ability of AI, you know, artificial intelligence, to predict the market will change all of that. We'll have to wait and see. So guessing market corrections based on a lunar or Mayan calendars is a fun exercise, and such prognostications are about as accurate as Punxsutawney Phil. So take all of this with a sense of humor and a huge pillar of salt. And don't forget, if you want to read all about this or listen again online, go to our website, stevepomerantz.com, and sign up for our weekly update where you'll get this stuff in your inbox every single week. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I would like to welcome Becky Quick back on the show. Becky is co-anchor of Squawk Box, seen Monday through Friday on CNBC, and she's also anchor of the nationally syndicated On the Money. You know, Becky always gets to the heart of the issues, and when she's conducting interviews of some of the world's richest and most influential investors, and she recently conducted a long interview with Warren Buffett about his most recent shareholder letter, which was published in his annual report. Welcome back to the show, Beck.
Hey, Steve, it's great to be here with you. Thanks for asking.
So this was the 53rd annual letter to shareholders. What was different about this one?
You know, this letter was a little different. He stripped away the boilerplate of things that he's been putting in the letter for years and years, just ways to measure the business, stripped away some of that. And I think made it more of a, kind of a heartfelt letter, trying to help investors understand how to value Berkshire. There's some differences that are taking place. I think the number one was the big changes, the impact from the recent tax legislation that added a lot to Berkshire's bottom line. And then secondly, there are some accounting changes that are going to be put into place. And for a company like Berkshire, which has so many holdings in other companies, the stocks that it owns in so many of the big blue chip companies, that accounting change will kind of skew the bottom line so that you won't have as clear of an idea of what's happening with the operations of the businesses that it owns outright.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. So first of all, let's talk about the taxes and the tax cut. There was a $29 billion increase, an extra increase in the net worth of Berkshire because of the tax cuts, but it really wasn't in the form of cash. It was kind of in the form of, you know, future deferred liabilities. Can you just talk about mm-hmm. that very briefly?
Yeah, I mean, Buffett kind of breaks this down in a way that makes it so easy to understand. The way he looks at it is you own the business, but as a shareholder, for every share you buy, the government was getting 35% mm-hmm. of future profits and you were getting 65%. With the changes in the tax law, you know, you get a big increase because the government's going to be taking a smaller part. So
yeah,
it does make the company more valuable overall. It's a big number. It does skew things a bit, but I hadn't really thought about it that way until Warren Buffett laid it out that way.
I think when you're an owner of a business, you know, the way he looks at it, you know, he's an owner, he's going, hey, this is my money. Oh, but no, 35% is not mine. So, you know, it's a little bit different than many of us think about it. This accounting change, though, I know this stuff sounds boring and I don't want listeners to tune out here. This accounting change is really important, you know, because you said it's going to skew the numbers, and it is going to skew the numbers. And I just wondered whether he was going to publish another set of numbers to kind of adjust it. Did he say anything about that?
Yeah, I don't think he's going to report a different set of numbers, but he will in his letter every year. He made a point of saying he will in his letter every year try and break out the accounting differences and the, you know, the values that rise and drop so rapidly with share prices and some of the things that go along with that to try and break out the actual operations of the companies they own outright.
That'll be helpful.
He's got more like 65 or 70 different businesses that Berkshire owns outright. And what he wants to make sure that shareholders understand is how those businesses are operating. And, and so I think he'll go out of his way in every letter from here on out to really make sure that they make a clear case for it, despite what the government requires or what the agencies require, SEC requires with accounting rules. He'll make a point of explaining to people what's happening.
I think the idea that what the government is doing is wrong. I think he thinks it's wrong as well. We won't get into the details.
You know, I'm not even sure he thinks it's wrong as much as it's wrong for Berkshire. Berkshire's a very unique company.
Yeah.
If you're not a company that, you know, Berkshire's got billions and billions of dollars in stocks that it owns.
Yeah.
And so that can really skew things.
Yeah.
I don't think he thinks the government's trying to do a bad thing, but it doesn't make sense for a diversified company like Berkshire.
Yeah, also other insurance companies. You mentioned Chubb,
where
they have stocks as well. So let's move on here. You know, Berkshire currently has a cash hoard of $116 billion that he's desperate to put to work, but he says that he can't really find anything right now at the right price. Is he saying the market is overvalued?
You know, Steve, it's so funny that you say that because when I read the letter, that's the same thing I thought. Wow, if Warren Buffett says that they can't find a business to buy, that must mean that stocks writ large are overvalued and that the stock market is getting into bubblicious territory. And I asked him that. And he said, no, that's not really the case, that they are still buying stock. The Berkshire is still actively buying shares of other companies. They've been net buyers in the year to date for the first couple of months of the year. But he can't find a business that he wants to buy outright because in order to buy an entire company, you have to be willing to pay a premium. So if you're looking at paying a 15, 20, 30, 40% premium, then he thinks that things are overvalued. But he said, if you're just somebody who's buying individual shares, you know, that's still worth doing. And even, you know, he at Berkshire is still putting money to work to the tune of billions of dollars that they've been. I think he said that they've spent $3 to $3.5 billion net at the beginning part of this year. And that's even with Phillips buying back some shares. So they've been spending billions of dollars in the market to buy individual pieces of companies. They just can't find a company, a big company that they'd like to buy outright and pay that premium.
It's harder to swallow the whole cow, you know, it just costs more, you know.
Right.
But buying individual stocks. So I thought his thinking was bifurcated there as well. And I wanted listeners to understand the difference because, you know, everybody, the pundits talk about, oh, the market's so overvalued and so on. So we want to know what Buffett is thinking about the stock market. And he's saying, no, you know, he's finding places to go and buy stocks. So I think that was very important.
I think so, too. That was one of the, one of the most important takeaways I took from it, because I went into that interview thinking he was going to say that stock prices were getting expensive, and that's not at all what he said.
So he's got $116 billion. He's really looking for a great market sell-off. Not that he's wishing for that, but that's when he buys his, gets his best deals. But there's other things that he can do with this $116 billion. He can establish, declare a dividend, and he talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Why won't he just do that?
I think, you know, he's always been against the idea of a dividend because he feels like if he can't make better use of it, the whole way Berkshire was set up was to create insurance companies in the beginning, and that would kick off a float, and then he felt he could be a better investor and make more on that money than you'd be able to otherwise if he gave it back to you. He said he looks at Berkshire kind of as a savings account. And for the early investors, that's what it was. They gave all their excess money to him.
Yeah.
He found the best way to put it to use and to get a higher return on investment for people. I think he still feels that he can get a higher return on investment for people, and that, you know, having that money away, sitting around for a rainy day serves a purpose. Berkshire really went to work back in 2008 and 2009 in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And you're right, the rainy days are the great days for Berkshire because they have the ability to stand in when everybody else is running for the exits. And because they are so conservative, they can really have a lot of excess cash that they can put to work in those times.
Yeah.
He didn't rule out the idea of ever having a dividend, but I think right now he still thinks that he's in a position of being able to eventually put that money better to use than giving it back to shareholders. The other things he's pointed out in the past about a dividend is that's not a tax advantageous situation for shareholders. You give them the money back and they're going to have to pay taxes on it. Whereas if you can reinvest it within the Berkshire entity, as shareholders, they're not paying taxes on those gains. They're just getting gains that are accumulated to the bottom line. But I was a little surprised by that too, Steve, that he didn't rule out the idea of a dividend, because maybe there is a point where he feels like he can't make a better return on investment than just giving it back to shareholders.
Well, he also said it's an implied promise that you're going to keep paying forever, not decrease the dividend and so on. So he would even think of a repurchase. He's talked about that in the past, and he set a limit of 120% of book value as his number where he would come in. And I think that he, under special circumstances, he would increase that maybe to 125, 127%. Now, everybody, listen, you can go online and you can find out what the book value per share of Berkshire Hathaway is, both the A and the B shares, and you can multiply it times 125%. And you'll see the number that we're talking about. It's not rocket science. My guest is Becky Quick. Becky, of course, is the co-anchor of Squawk Box. We all love her. She's on Monday through Friday on CNBC and also the anchor of On the Money as well. All right, so let's talk about some of the little bit more sensitive issues around today. There were questions that you read from other watchers of your show about investing in gun manufacturers. What did he say about that?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's been a politically charged topic in the wake of the shootings at that school in Florida. And there have been calls for companies that are involved with either the selling or manufacture of guns to maybe put down some laws that don't look like they're very likely to pass Congress. Things like raising the age that you can buy guns at, things along those lines. And some companies have waded into that. Buffett says he's reluctant to play sides on some of these things because in some ways it can be a slippery slope, right? One person's rallying cry is you're stepping on someone else's toes. And I think he typically wants to keep Berkshire out of the fray with some of those things. Now, Warren Buffett is somebody who was very clear in his support of both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, but he says that he never wants to put his political beliefs on Berkshire shareholders or on the Berkshire companies. And so his point is like, look, there's a million other things that the board should be talking about. And by the way, they don't manufacture guns or weapons or sell them. So this is a little bit of a theoretical question when it comes down to it. But his point is that you can run down an entire gamut of issues that you're going to be dividing the country and basically alienating half your customers if you wade into some of these things. And he just doesn't want to put Berkshire as a company in that position.
Yeah, he said he has his own personal views, but they may or may not be Berkshire's views. I think he made that pretty clear. Okay, so let's talk about his bet. We only have a few minutes left. Let's talk about his bet with the hedge fund managers. That was 10 years ago. They both put up, I think, $300,000+. And the idea was to get it to $500,000, and then two of them together would have equaled $1 million. And he bet on the S&P 500, the unmanaged, low-cost S&P 500 index, and he bet against a fund manager, Protégé Partners, which had access to all, like 200 of the best and brightest hedge funds. How did they do?
Well, Buffett blew the hedge fund managers out of the water with his simple bet on the S&P 500. And this is a point he's been trying to illustrate for years, Steve. You know this too. Just the idea that average investors are going to get taken advantage of by Wall Street. Because if you're an average investor, you're not going to be able to get He says he probably only knows about five hedge fund managers or five managers in the world who would be able to outperform the S&P 500 on a regular basis.
Wow.
So most of us are not going to have access to that.
Yeah.
And if you are paying for someone to manage your money, you are paying often a big fee, maybe 250 basis points or more, to get them to manage, to move you in and out of stocks, to take advantage of all these things, to make decisions all the time. And so the point is, we're not experts. We shouldn't be trying to do this. We've all got day jobs. This is not our job.
Right.
So just put your money aside. Don't worry about it. Let it go. And you'll do better. He wanted to prove that you could do better by doing that. And so his point came out. I forget what the actual numbers are. I don't know if you have it right in front of you, but the S&P 500 blew it out of the water.
Yeah, well, the S&P 500 was up 8.5%, and the average of the managers was 2.9%.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not even close.
On an annualized basis, right.
Yeah, and annualized.
And so he keeps trying to prove to people, you don't have to pay Wall Street to do all these things. You don't have to be super sophisticated. That if you are simply an investor with a long-term outlook and you have a lot of years to invest and you continue to put money aside and don't get panicked, don't sell just because
the
market crashed.
Key. There's the key.
Right. Let it ride.
So I think he's talking about two separate things here. Number one, the actual money management itself, the day-to-day buying of stocks and other instruments just to try to outperform the S&P 500. Now, this may be a little bit biased because I am an investment advisor, but I can tell you for the 36 years that I've been sitting at this desk, people do need help with their emotions and making the right decisions.
He made that point, too,
that
like, look, the biggest thing is you need to be unemotional in getting into these things. You can't run and trade with it. And his whole point is if you have that ability to be unemotional in those trades, then this is what you should do. But you're right. There are a lot of people who want to sell when everybody else is. They panic. They see it on nightly news and they want to immediately run out and sell just because everybody else is running. And that's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Becky, thank you for joining us. You know, to hear this interview again, to read the facts covered on this topic, we'll also give you a link to the annual report from Warren Buffett so you can read it for yourself. It's incredibly readable and it's really for all of us to sit. And there's lots of other lessons there about trading on margin and so on and so forth. Don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. Becky Quick, thank you so much for taking your time to join us today.
Steve, thank you. It's always a pleasure. So thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Now that some of the Bitcoin hysteria has subsided, I thought it would be a good time to take a fresh look at it, a fresh look at it and all the cryptocurrencies that have been created. And I've asked Christian Magoon, a veteran in the exchange-traded fund arena, to join me today to see if there are any new areas of focus in the digital marketplace. Hey, Christian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Great to be on and listen to you on iTunes quite often. So pleasure to be not only a listener, but a guest.
That's great. So remember, everybody, we're on iTunes and you can podcast us. So let's get from the very beginning. Let's say I've never heard of Bitcoin or blockchain. Let's start with blockchain, because that seems to be the area that people think really have amazing long-term potential. So what is blockchain?
Yeah, so blockchain is a foundational technology. And one way to think about it is to go back maybe 20 years when we learned about another foundational technology called the internet. And a lot of us learned about the internet for the first time by encountering a website or using email. That was an application built on internet technology. Okay. So Bitcoin is an application, as are other cryptocurrencies, that's built on blockchain technology. And what blockchain technology is a decentralized ledger, or another way of saying it is it's like a massive data spreadsheet that's not held on one computer, and instead it's held on many computers. And it's a network that really stores, verifies, and secures data. So some people have said the internet is like the information superhighway. Blockchain is like the data verification and transaction superhighway.
Okay.
It creates a trusted way to transact all around data.
So if you create a transaction, and what exactly happens that allows that transaction to be spread, I guess, to different computers around the world to be tracked back to its original source? How does that work?
So there's essentially a network of computers that form the blockchain. And there's public blockchains, something like Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies where you or I could buy a Bitcoin. We suddenly become part of that network. Then there's private networks where maybe a group of companies or service providers would enter in that's just for them. But essentially, data is entered into the blockchain in the form of a block. And that block and that piece of data then needs to be verified by an algorithm that all the computers on the network share. And essentially, it involves cryptography and decoding whether or not that piece of data is valid. Once it's confirmed by one computer and they quote-unquote solve it, by the way, that's called mining, then all the other computers take that answer and run it backwards to verify it. Once it's verified, that piece of information or that piece of data, the block, gets chained to all previous other blocks or pieces of data in this blockchain group.
Hmm.
That's really where it gets its name. And that's one of the unique parts about blockchain is that there's not one central party that decides if data is correct or not, that stores the data.
Right.
And that offers a lot of interesting implications when it comes to speed, trust, as well as cybersecurity.
Wow, good answer. Actually, I understood it. So congratulations. So where does Bitcoin come in? I mean, you said it's an application based on this blockchain, but it's an application that does what? I mean, I know what email does. What does Bitcoin do?
Well, you know, Bitcoin really, I think, is designed as a store of value. Some people would say it's a commodity. Other people would say it's a currency. It's kind of up for debate. But essentially, it's a store of value. And with that Bitcoin, you can actually go out and hopefully transact, whether it's trading or buying different types of potential intellectual property, or maybe even a pizza. In a famous case where someone paid, I think, 10,000 Bitcoin for a pizza when it was near worthless.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the important point to think about Bitcoin or Ethereum or any of these other cryptocurrencies is cryptocurrencies need blockchain, but blockchain doesn't need cryptocurrencies. It's just the first application that was built using blockchain. And this goes back to 2008. The creator of kind of blockchain and Bitcoin published a paper. We're not sure if it's an individual or it's a group of people that outlined blockchain technology in its first application called Bitcoin. So in one case, Bitcoin is a store of value. There's other types of cryptocurrencies that represent other stores of value. So some cryptocurrencies might represent the ability to use some computing power of the blockchain to essentially borrow some computing power to solve a problem. Others might be involved in the ability to transfer money. Ripple is one that's known there and is being embraced by many financial institutions to do money transfer, including cross-border. So all these different cryptocurrencies generally have a unique purpose. Although with that being said, there are scams out there. And one really has to understand the use of this cryptocurrency. Often it's theoretical. Not many of them are actually in use. But that's really kind of how you assess potentially the viability of a cryptocurrency.
All right. So let me ask you a question here. I understand as an investment person, I understand what a store of value is. I can see that gold would be considered a store of value because it has a certain finite amount, or it's a finite resource, number one. And number two, it's desirable to many for jewelry and just for its very nature. Actually, gold is fairly pretty much indestructible. So I understand that as a value because it's in demand and it's desirable. I can't understand where the value is in Bitcoin. It doesn't seem to give me anything back.
Yeah, and I think that's a great kind of approach looking at gold. So like gold, Bitcoin, there is a scarcity to it. Like gold, where it's probably the most widely accepted precious metal or store of value in the metals complex worldwide, Bitcoin is the most widely accepted type of cryptocurrency worldwide. Like gold, you could potentially take a gold coin to almost anywhere in the world and get some quote-unquote hard currency or fiat currency. Bitcoin has that fungibility as well to do cross-border transactions, to show up in another country and translate that Bitcoin into some type of hard monetary value. However, as you know, gold isn't as volatile. And that's one of the issues around Bitcoin right now. If it's a store of value, what is it really worth? We've seen it worth several $1,000s in the last year and a half, and you know, $20,000 in the last year and a half. So it hasn't matured yet to really have kind of the stable form of value. And to me, that's one of the underlying issues that, in my opinion, makes it more of a speculative alternative investment than a true store of value like gold.
Oh, that's a great answer. Yeah, I would agree. I think I can't figure out how to value it. So I would not want to buy it except as a speculation. And as anyone knows, a speculation can return a wonderful rate of return, but you can also lose everything or most of everything with a speculation like that. Let's get back to blockchain for a moment. So it's this digital ledger. You know, a ledger, when I hear the word ledger, I think of kind of the old style. You open up this book and there's two columns there, you know, debits and credits, and you're keeping track of all the money that's coming in. You're keeping track of all the money that's going out. And, you know, that's your ledger. So a digital ledger sounds to me like kind of the same thing, only it's digital and it's spread and it's checked and rechecked and, you know, algorithmically proofed by all of these other computers. And I also got to understand a little bit about this when Kodak announced that they were going to be using blockchain for their photographers. And then I started to really understand that, first of all, I didn't even know Kodak was still in business, but that a photographer who has this intellectual property, maybe they sell their stuff to sites like Shutterstock and others, and people license their material. You know, I would think it would be hard for them to prove that they actually own something, or very cumbersome anyway, to prove, hey, this is my photo and then I've got, you know, here's my proof. But if you use blockchain and that digital information is now traceable back to its source, wow, I thought that's pretty powerful. Can you take it from there?
Yeah, I think that's a great example of a kind of an innovative use. And not only could that intellectual property be tracked, but then you could actually be paid through that blockchain. I think Kodak is, you know, talking about not only having the ability to track that intellectual property like photographs digitally, but then also for companies that use those, that intellectual property, be able to then repatriate some licensing fee or revenue through that blockchain back to the actual creator. But you're exactly right. You know, I think blockchain's big promise is that in a lot of ways, it eliminates kind of the middleman that, you know, typically was providing friction in any transaction. It takes them time to go in between the two parties. There's cost involved. In this case, you know, if Kodak is using this blockchain with photographers, it's really the block kind of a peer-to-peer commerce. Photographers use the blockchain and it goes right to the end user. The end user secures those rights and then sends payment back on the blockchain. There's not an accounting program or a payment verification. It's very efficient. It also creates, you know, trust. When you think about how do you trust that you can actually license this image, or how do you trust that someone's going to pay you for this image? The blockchain does that because it only releases the image if there's payment. There's also a lot of security around this. So because this is a blockchain and there's not one single ledger, the ledgers are on thousands of computers, all updated and verified in real time. There's not something called a single attack vector. And that simply means there's not one point that can be attacked that has all the information. Today, when we look at data, payments, transactions, and we see a lot of these cyber attacks, it's because there's essentially a centralized point of information that they're able to attack. And by that single attack, they're able to get the information. In a blockchain, you'd have to literally attack thousands of computers at once to bring the blockchain down, because taking one computer out doesn't affect the rest of the blockchain. So,
but hold on. Try and understand this. But isn't all the information from that transaction or on that block contained on each computer? It's not as if these thousands of computers have little parts of the information. So you can steal one and get it all, can't you?
Well, if you did steal one computer, you have a cryptographic key that you'd actually have to go in and decrypt the actual access to the blockchain. And then, you know, you couldn't steal information from the blockchain because you could access it. And there's varying levels of types of blockchain in terms of what permissions and a user can get. But if you were on a public blockchain, you stole someone's computer, you decrypted yourself into the blockchain. Mm-hmm. There's no ability for you to change what's in the blockchain. It's immutable.
Yeah.
There's no pencil and eraser that you can go out and do it. What you could potentially do is try to add a false block, if you will, or set of information.
Yeah.
But ultimately, that wouldn't be proved out because all the other computers would have to verify it, and that there would be an error. Good. However, you could steal someone's key to their Bitcoin and actually be able to go in and essentially unlock their vault where their Bitcoin is,
and that's kept. And that's definitely happened before. So.
Yes, with exchanges and individuals who own cryptocurrencies.
I'm talking with Christian Magoon. He is really a veteran in the exchange-traded fund arena, and we're going to talk about a fund that he and his company has created to help you invest in blockchain. So we've got about 2 minutes left. So, you know, as investors who are not actually doing any transactions in blockchain or may not own Bitcoin, as we said, which is speculative, I think there are starting to be some ways to invest in this blockchain technology. And you're involved with a blockchain ETF that was created, the symbol BLOK. Tell us a little bit about that. We have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, so we believe for longer term investors, the approach to take to blockchain technology is really to invest in the underlying technology, not necessarily speculate on cryptocurrencies, but really invest in the pick in the axes, the infrastructure of blockchain, because of so many disruptions that it's likely to start to promote in various industries, whether that's banking and stock exchanges, logistics, record keeping, computing and media. So what we've done is we've put together a group of blockchain engaged companies. Mm-hmm. These are publicly traded companies that are the leaders in investing in private blockchain companies, research and development in their own companies. And also there's a variety of companies that already receive revenue from blockchain related activities. So we've bundled these group of companies together, about 50 of them around the world, that we think provide a great infrastructure play on blockchain. We think it's a little bit like investing in the internet 20 years ago. You don't really know who the winners are going to be, but you can kind of look at the groups that are most engaged now as being a healthy group to have one of the leaders or many of the leaders emerge from.
Very good. All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. So to all my listeners, listen, we're just talking about the facts. We're not making any predictions. Please, please do your homework before making any investment decisions. You can definitely lose money in investments and investments like this that are especially new and in a sense, untested. Be very careful. Get yourself a prospectus and read it. Talk to your investment advisor and all of those other things that I always say all the time. Be careful out there. Hey, if you want to hear the interview again and want to get these and many more informative interviews straight to your inbox, subscribe to our weekly update at stevepomerantz.com. And if you have a question about what was just discussed, ask us. Go to stevepomerantz.com and ask us anything you'd like. That's stevepomerantz.com. Hey, Christian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You know, last week we talked about the right to inspect, and as we were discussing this show this week, you said you wanted to get into more detail, because I know this is important. What is it that you want to tell us?
You know, Steve, a lot of people don't realize, and they don't understand what it means, as is with right to inspect. And especially the sellers, they get a little frustrated when, you know, that you've negotiated a deal that are selling it as is, but they don't understand with the right to inspect. So this is what it means. So the buyer reserves the right to have the property inspected. And if they don't like it, they have three choices. They can accept the contract the way it is, the condition of the property, and move forward. B, they can try to renegotiate with the seller. Or C, just flat out walk away. Now, the problem is there's a time limit. There's usually, say, anywhere from 7 to 10 days, depending on what you negotiate, to get those inspections completed. Mm. So typically what happens is, you know, let's say it's 10 days that you have for the inspections. You get the report back on day 8. You go through the report. It's now day 9.
Mm.
You want the house, but there's items on that report you want the seller to take care of. So on day 9, you tell your agent and you reach out to the seller and say, hey, Mr. Seller, I'd like to move forward, but I want you to take care of these 2 items. And then the seller says, okay, I'll go ahead and take care of it. Well, you really have to cement that in writing. If you don't have that in writing and you're taking the word that the seller is going to take care of it, you're putting yourself in jeopardy here, because A, you don't have it in writing. The seller can, you know, decide he's not going to do it. You have to proceed because, you know, once you get to day 10, you can lose your deposit if you, you know, don't go through with it, or you have to, you know, keep going forward with the condition in which the property has been presented to you. So
let me ask you this question. Let me just interject here. So first
sure.
of all, that sounds incredibly nerve-wracking.
It is very nerve-wracking as an agent when you're watching the clock and you know that they verbally have put things together, but now you're trying to put it in writing. And so what's really tricky about getting in writing, if your cutoff is, you know, 5 p.m. and it's the day of, you know, the last day, and you're putting it in writing and the buyer says, okay, I'm going to proceed. Here's what I want the seller to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the seller doesn't sign it by 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? You could be, you know.
Yeah.
So here's what's important. You've got to put the proper language in when you write up those addendums. Basically, you're going to say something to the effect, and again, consult your attorney, because I don't want to give you the exact language of what should be written in there. But the idea is you go back to the buyer in the event that the contract isn't executed by, you know, 5 o'clock, you know, this day, then the buyer reserves the right to cancel this contract under the as is with right to inspect clause. So you're making a statement, you're sharing with the seller, Mr. Seller, if you don't sign this and you don't agree with this by such and such a time, I still am reserving my right to cancel the contract. That's your safety net.
Okay, but let's talk about the other side of the transaction. You, as a buyer, have put down a deposit.
Right.
The inspection, you've got 10 days. The inspection comes back in day 8. You've got now 48 hours to submit a new addendum and get it signed by both parties.
Correct. If you're asking them to make repairs, correct.
Yeah. So, and if it's not done within the 10 days, you're going to lose your deposit?
Well, no, you're not going to lose your deposit. You're going to lose your right to get anything done. You're going to be forced to proceed in the as-is condition.
Oh, okay.
And if you choose not to, then you're going to lose your deposit.
So if you submit it in writing as the buyer, it's still not considered enough because you have to have the seller's signature as well.
That's correct. And this is where I see a lot of contracts get into big trouble because they'll verbally have said they agree to do it, But you can't rely on that. You have to follow it up in writing, mm-hmm. unless you're really willing to accept the fact that if they don't do it, it's as is.
Which, if you found problems, you're not going to be willing to do that.
Right. It depends on how serious it is. Some of these issues, some of the buyers will say, well, if the seller will take care of it, it'll make me happy.
Yeah, okay.
Depends on the severity of it. But, you know, if you really want the seller to take care of something, what's important to understand is there is a timeline. It has to be fully executed by that time and day.
Yeah, do it right and do it quick.
Correct. Do it right, do it quick. Don't dilly-dally. I can't tell you how many times, you know, I beg my buyers, order the inspection immediately after we've got an executed contract, because it takes sometimes 4 or 5 days for an inspector to get out there.
And then they got to actually create the report.
And then they got to do it and then get the report back to you. And then if there's issues, you might want to research it. Yeah. And now you're up against the 10th day or the 7th day, whatever the end of the inspection period is.
Okay.
And you're scrambling.
As my father used to say, forewarned is forearmed.
That's right.
I think we get it. Let's change gears here. So here's a question. Condo owners are sometimes at odds with the board because sometimes the board wants to do renovations and there's individuals who live in the condo that feel that they can do those renovations. And you've got an example here where an elevator was going to be replaced and there was a demand that the association retained certain tenants because they had internal expertise. What's the deal on that? We got about a minute left.
Yeah, no good. Don't do it.
No good.
No good. No way, Jose. Here's the problem. As a board, you have the responsibility to hire currently licensed professional people. And you're also creating a huge liability, a catastrophic liability potential for your association for loss of insurance coverages if there's problems arise. It's a great idea and a thought of having somebody within the association take care of these things, but they can work along the side with the contractor, maybe be a liaison, if you will,
maybe watch
an
over
internal
them.
Expertise.
Yeah,
but
report back to the board.
Don't even touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
Do it right. Hire someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the board's got fiduciary responsibility here. You want to have someone that's licensed in the state. You also want to take bids from people who are in the business, and you want to be very, very careful. We are out of time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
If you own a digital currency or are contemplating purchasing one, my next guest and I talk about the surprising tax consequences of ownership. Stay tuned. StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. You know, we talk a lot about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and others like that, but we never really talk about the taxable aspects of owning these currencies. And this kind of got my attention, so I invited Ryan Losey. Ryan is a partner and executive vice president of PASIC in Glen Allen, Virginia, and he leads the firm's international tax practice and advises on digital currency holders. And he's with me right now. Welcome him to the show. Hey, Ryan, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
So anyone who bought or sold digital currencies in 2017 are going to have to report profits on their federal tax returns. Now, that's not really surprising, but what is surprising is the way the IRS is kind of splitting hairs as to whether you're an owner or you use it for a transaction or you're even a miner. So let's start with an owner. 2017 comes along. I decide, hey, I want to own some Bitcoin. I buy it at, you know, $5,000. It goes to $10,000 and I sell it. What kind of taxes am I liable for?
Sure. So Steve, what you're supposed to do, and really kind of what the IRS has indicated in their guidance to the public was, you need to track the date of acquisition as well as what was the trading price during that day to establish your cost basis.
Okay.
And then you're supposed to track when you had a sale or a disposition, you know, a sale or exchange. So okay. It could be an outright sale, and you know, let's say you've converted it over to cash or some other foreign currency. Mm-hmm. U.S. citizen outside the U.S.
Yeah.
But it's also exchange. So if you took that value and exchanged it for service, you know, you went out and bought a vehicle, you paid for Starbucks coffee, then that would also generate a taxable event. And so you're supposed to track that, and that date would trigger whether or not it was a short-term or long-term capital gain for purposes of the lower long-term capital gains rates.
Wow. You know, I could see buying it and then selling it, fine, you pay your capital gains. And by the way, there's no 1099 that's issued. You better keep very good records when you're doing this, because again, there's no Fidelity or Schwab out there going to be sending you a 1099 at the end of the year, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the point is the service did an analysis of how many taxpayers were reporting Schedule D capital gains from the sale of and exchange of virtual currencies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was under 1,000 returns.
Yeah.
But there's also Coinbase has over 12 million account holders.
Someone is not reporting. Is that what you're trying to say?
I think that's a pretty wise assumption.
Okay. All right. But here's what really throws me for a loop. So I've got these Bitcoins. I bought 5 Bitcoins at, you know, whatever, next to nothing. And I decide that I want to go get a cup of coffee. And in this fake world where you can actually use Bitcoin for something like this without paying all the fees and all of that, where it actually makes sense, you buy your coffee or you buy a car or whatever, you know, you go to the movies, you use it for that. You now have to pay taxes on the sale, the difference between your purchase price and the actual sale, even though you're not officially selling it. You're just using the coin. You're thinking of it as a currency, but the IRS isn't thinking of it that way.
Well, the IRS treats it as property, and it's property that has value, and that's the reason why. You're exchanging that property, and that's where it comes in with regards to determining gain or loss. Now, if the price is continuing to increase, then you're right. There will be a tax consequence from a standpoint of there's maybe some tax due because there's a gain. But if there's a declining value from the time you exchanged it, there could be a capital loss.
Okay. Fair enough. So it's almost like you went to pay for this stuff with a certificate of stock. That's the way I think.
That's the best way to look at it.
So yeah, hey, I've got this stock. I'll give you, you know, one share of XYZ as payment for this car. And well, the IRS is going to look at that. Well, you actually sold that stock. So it'd be the same thing as a currency. Cool.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, let's say that I was a miner, M-I-N-E-R, who created these currencies basically out of thin air using your computer and some complicated algorithms. How is the tax treatment for that?
Well, the IRS's public position that they issued guidance on is they treat that specific transaction as you've got these computers that are generating hash and you happen to, you know, get the right algorithm right, and all of a sudden, you know, you let's take Bitcoin, for example, you get a one Bitcoin, you know, debited to your virtual wallet. The IRS says that you need to treat that as if that was a payment for a service that you've provided, so a service payment, which is, it's gross income. It's just like if you were doing contractor work and received a 1099 for payment for your services.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gross income, and it goes on your tax return.
Yeah, so who is on the other side of this transaction? You've got to have two people.
Well, that's the problem, is that practitioners like myself, and in this, you know, service-based income, you know, there's two parties.
Yeah.
There's two parties. There's one that received the service and the one that made the payment. And in the context of virtual currency and mining, if you're mining, you know, like out there in the gold mine, you pay, you know, lease someone's land to go out and dig, and you find a gold nugget, or you got a Bitcoin that was, you know, that you solved an algorithm, there is no other party receiving a service.
Mm-hmm.
You've just identified something. So, you know, a lot of practitioners are looking at it going, if you're a miner, you know, you may not want to follow the IRS's guidance, and you may want to take a position that it's not a recognizable event until you dispose of that virtual currency that you mined.
Yeah.
It's not like you went out and bought it.
Right, right.
And so, and that's a big question, is it taxable upon receipt when you're a miner, or is it not? And I think there is a position to say that it's not.
Well, you know, we're running out of time here. So I think the bottom line is that we talk a lot about cryptocurrencies. We're going to be talking about them a lot more as the years unfold. But nobody talks about the taxes and the fact that really every time you do something, you're paying the government a pretty much a fairly whopping amount of the value of that coin or currency. So watch out, be careful, and know what you're doing before you do it. My guest, Ryan Losey, partner, executive vice president for PASIC. And by the way, that's PISCIK.com. Of course, we will have that on our website. And don't forget that you can search all of our archives to find any topic that you would like, including topics on taxes and investments and everything else in this world. And to hear this interview again or to read the facts covered on this topic, go to stevepomerantz.com. Hey, Ryan, thanks for joining us so much.
Steve, thanks for having me.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.